Phantom Computers. This is Intelligent Performance.
Lucy Bloom, welcome to the Intelligent Performance Podcast. It is a pleasure to have you with us. We tried to get you on here a little while ago while you were going through a small cancellation or a vicious crowd trying to cancel you, which is an interesting topic, which I hope we can touch on today. Pleasure to have you with us. As we do with all guests, especially if someone of your caliber, we'd love to hear, what's your take on intelligent performance?
Oh, I take it at face value. It is about performing with informed performance. So, you know, you look at the facts, you consult the people who know better than you, and you perform thereafter. That's how I would see intelligent performance is cool. A team who know better than you and perform thereafter.
Informed intelligence, informed performance. I like that. I think some people kind of take it, they use it as a prompt to answer for 5 minutes and I put it in brevity.
Pretty straightforward person.
Let's keep it real. So, Lucy, for those who don't know, you are a professional speaker, an author, a former, you know, being a CEO, and now you speak on stage to thousands of people as a motivational speaker in that space. For those who are less familiar with your story, can you catch us up or catch those listeners up on a bit about you?
Sure thing. I'm just going to quickly quit the things that would be going ping in the background. There we go. A little bit of background on me. I spent 20 years running an advertising agency. That's how my career started out. Didn't expect to stick with something for quite that long because I bore easily. But at about the 20-year mark, I made the move into the not-for-profit sector, and I've been the CEO of two international aid charities, one in Ethiopia, one in Cambodia. I led a few other organisations after that. Then in 2017, I noticed that running companies was killing me. I had a long list of health ailments that like it was going to shorten my life expectancy. Then I read this incredible article about CEOs and this long list of health problems that CEOs tend to shoulder. And I thought, that is a question of me. And I still remember seeing a perfectly good beach disappear out the back window of the bus I was on to my office in the city. And I made the decision that day not to run companies anymore and have been a keynote speaker ever since. So I travel Australia and the world. I'm somewhere between a motivational speaker, a business expert, and a stand-up comedian.
Okay. They haven't got a label for you, Lucy, which is good.
And my hair makes me memorable, and I'm happy with that.
And the pink glasses, I'm going to get an order in after this. So it's
I've got about 10 colours of these glasses.
So let's touch on, that's a really interesting CV, right, in terms of, you know, and you're anyone who does a bit of research, as I have, into your world, you start to, you know, discover a very multicolored person. And I feel like society doesn't love multicolored people sometimes. And I mean that from a, like, with varied backgrounds, we try and say, oh, well, you must be a finance expert because you've done this for 50 years. So someone with your blendedness, what did you find when you did make that move from marketing into the nonprofit space? Was it super relatable? What were the biggest, how well did it relate? That's what I guess what I'm trying to get at.
It related better than you'd think, because most of charity work is marketing.
Right.
A huge role in that is getting the funding to do the work you want to do. The doing of the is often done by a completely separate team. The actual delivery of the work. And so we were funding a hospital and a midwifery school in Ethiopia. I wasn't doing the surgery. I was funding that and had millions of dollars to find. So that's a marketing and communication role. So it was really easily translated and really successful, because I've never stepped into an industry and had a look around and gone, oh, how's it done around here? I've just tried to figure out how my skill set can make the most of the challenge. And making it fun was actually really a really successful thing to do. The charity sector tends to be very serious. And it certainly was when I stepped into it in 2015. Really serious. People get compassion fatigue. If you keep telling them sad stories, they'll just roll on by. They're like, oh, I'll do another sad story today. And I remember reading an epic book called Jab, Jab, Cross, Hook. And it's about bringing your audience closer with easy to consume content or communications. And when they're nice and close and they think they're going to get another funny or heartwarming story, you get them with the cross hook, which is a heartbreaking story. You kind of ambush them with the sadness of the work, the stories of the work we were doing in Ethiopia. And then your next piece of communication is really fun. And the unexpectedness had incredible cut through. So all that learning from, you know, designing bikini catalogs, and I did all the press advertising for the National Rugby League for years. And so a very commercial background. I knew what would cut through. We were trying to sell something that's really unsexy and make it consumable. And I very quickly tapped into something that I knew I fell for, which, and humans love it. Humans love owning a thing. Like, yes, we want to buy a well and stick my name on it. And very quickly we could package up so people could pay for an operation in one of our hospitals. And that paying for the entirety of an operation worked really well. So we got people to double their usual annual donation because they could in a whole operation. So, yeah, it was very relatable going from an advertising background to fundraising just because it's still marketing communication. That's the short.
Essentially, it's the same. I love that. And I think that's what we love about this show. So we speak to thousands of different guests about intelligent performance, right? That being, what are the intricacies of performance in different niches? And what we find all the time is that it just relates so well. Like, you can might be a really good a guy who's done 39 diet protocols, as an example, who was one of my previous guests, and he was just like, well, actually, the big takeaway was like, just look beyond the marketing. Essentially, behind the marketing of all these diet fads is essentially the same fundamentals. And actually, that's what works. And that would be a truism, if we could call it that, of pretty much every single guest, especially. Look beyond the marketing and it's all the same.
And humans are humans. And so if you're working with humans in some way, humans are still humans. And so the way they will, say, respond to a story, or what you need to do to get them to part with their money and all they get back is a tax deductible receipt and a warm fuzzy. There's some rules in there that humans will respond to, because we're all little delicate egos on legs. And so you kind of have to respond to that. And I used to often say, we're emotional manipulators. That's what we do, is we get people to feel an emotion and open their wallet. And that works whether you're selling NRL tickets, bikinis, bricks, or like donations to a charity on the other side of the world where most people won't know where it is on a map. It's humans. Humans are humans.
Very cool. Tell me about motivation. You stand on stages and you speak to thousands of people. For many people, that would be a really scary thing to do, myself included. Exciting, I think, but also really scary and daunting, especially like the judgment, you know, like, oh my gosh, she's got pink hair and pink glasses. Like, oh my, who is this woman? You know, so just talk to me. Actually, I'd love to, a couple of things in that. Let's talk about the topic, first of all, motivation. What do you think people get wrong about this space? And then I actually really want to talk about how do you prepare for that sort of performance?
Sure. Okay. Remind me about the second bit when I get to that.
No worries.
What most people get wrong about motivation, and that's just one of the themes I speak on, is that they think motivation is coming to save them. And they literally lie around the house looking at the ceiling, waiting for some special tingly feeling that is going to propel them through something difficult or huge. And I simplify it by just saying motivation is not coming to get you. It's not coming help you. It's not going to save you. You actually have to start, and the motivation follows once you get going. And there's a mind game in motivation, and there's a physical game in motivation, and you have to get them to like collide, and that will propel you along. But none of that is like some flipping fairy coming to save you. That's what most people get wrong. They literally lie about on the internet saying, I'm so demotivated. And that's a mixture between physically feeling tired and low and mentally not getting over this thing that's stopping them.
I'm guessing this isn't your actual speech, though, because if you just got on stage as a motivational speaker to tell them that actually motivation is not coming to get you, that's not particularly motivating to hear. Is that right?
Well, you can. I'm a big believer in surprise and delight and a bit of shock. Okay. And all. So you can shock an audience by going, "Sorry, motivation's not coming." Then you can give them. Okay, this is how you actually get moving. This, you know, you give people tactics and take home. This is how you stop relying on something that's not going to happen and start putting in place the things you need to get moving. You've got to move first, motivation comes later. So
there's a lot of talk about discipline at the moment in terms of that's kind of really having, feel like that's really coming to the fore. What's your take on that in terms of, you know, you need to rely on discipline more than motivation?
Oh, absolutely. Because like I said, motivation comes afterwards. So a bit of discipline is what will get you out of bed, will get you to push through things that you get like a feeling in your tummy. It's like this basic roadblock comes at you like a feeling in your guts that you don't want to do it. And you got to figure out what it is you need just to push through. Is it the carrot at the end? Do you just need distractions? So I figured out distractions, what I need. I just need to put my headphones on, accept that it's going to suck and get it over with. And if I'm listening to something awesome enough, I'll get whatever it is done. But yeah, discipline comes first. Motivation will follow through afterwards naturally.
Interesting. And the performance piece, huge crowd of people, you know, the bodily functions, the bodily anxiety of what that might show up as. How do you navigate all that?
Yeah, sure. It used to terrify me too. And I think it all comes down to familiarity. I speak on courage a lot, and a lot of building courage, accessing your own bravery is just about familiarity. Things that used to scare you won't after you've done them over and over and over. Mm. And I actually refer to the training that paratroopers go through in the Australian military. They're not expected to be brave. They are expected to fall back on their training, to just do things that they have in their muscle memory. And they are so familiar with jumping out of aeroplanes and arming themselves. That comes down to just familiarity, repetition. So I've done enough speeches that I know the audience isn't going to hate me. So there's... some people find it just harrowing, the thought of all those eyeballs on you and what if I screw up. So I've done enough reps that I know I won't screw up. And as far as preparation for that goes, there are this is a complicated answer. As far as nerves go, these days I just feel excited. I'm really excited to deliver to that room full of people because I know they're going to have a fall. I'm a funny speaker because no one ever said, how great was that really boring speaker? Your memory is better. You'll remember someone's content better if you've had a really good belly laugh along the way. You trigger all the right hormones and, so I enjoy the fun delivery and I enjoy getting better at that. And I've actually worked with a comedian who's shown me where in some of my stories I could actually be funnier, where there's a gap that I could easily make a great joke in. He doesn't write the jokes for me. He's just taught me where to see the potential for laughs.
I love that.
And I find when I'm on stage, the longer I've got an audience just looking at me, if there's been less laughs per minute, say over the last 5 minutes, I realise I need to change pace because their attention span is just as short as mine. And then I keep up the storytelling and the flow and they just can't get bored. And neither do I. Hooray. As far as nerves go, my heart still pounds before I go on. And I heard another speaker say something that is so gorgeous, so true. He said, I used to have horrific butterflies before I went on, and now those butterflies fly in formation. Cool. So you're just really prepared. You've done this before. You've practiced. Pretty much every single speech, I throw in some new content I've never done before because it would be pretty terrifying, and I have done this before, and it does suck when you do a whole new speech. So a 45-minute or 60-minute presentation in content you've never done to a full room before, you've only done in your car or at home. That's terrifying because you've got to remember so much and so many of the connections between pieces in that whole So I practice new content in just about every speech. Sometimes I just shoehorn a story in there for fun so I can practice it, but also practice in conversation. So I tell stories in conversation, and if those people love them, I think might pop that in a speech sometime. If they react really well, I think that might work well with an audience. So I'm really prepared. That's why it doesn't scare me anymore.
And the preparedness piece. So tell me, how long does it take you to practice? Are you doing 100 things? Are you just doing it 10 times? Are you doing it a few times? What do you find these days? Like, how well drilled do you need to be?
Yeah, I reckon it takes 10 goes to have a full hour locked in my memory. And the best way to do that is to go on a road show. So you're paid really well. You're sent to 10 cities. You give the same speech, and they want the identical speech. You give the same speech 6, 8, 10 times. You'll never forget that speech. Same introduction, same MC. Like, it's this fabulous rehearsal set for you. I coach up and coming speakers, and I suggest to them that to get their reps in, because you need a real audience for it to matter. So some people say they practice to their house plants, and I can't, because I can't take the plant seriously. I need a real audience to really, like, my brain cannot screw this up. So I suggest that they go and book in a year's worth of rotary groups that are within driving distance of home, one a week for a year, and do a 30-minute speech to rotary groups, and you will get really good. Rotary groups are full of older people. That is changing, but older people will be very blunt with you. You will get very blunt feedback. So do it for free. Do 52 of them in a year, or 50 in a year, and 30 minutes, it will be your hit song. You will be able to, if someone says, "Oh my goodness, a speaker cancelled on us," and you're sitting in the audience, you can say, "I can do my thing." It'll be really locked in memory. So real rep under real conditions really works.
That's amazing. Have you done that, the rotary thing?
I haven't. I did something different. I created my own ticketed event, and I didn't know I was doing this in preparation to be a full-time speaker. This was 20 years ago. I just had my first child, and I created the world's first childbirth education program for men, and it's run in pubs all over Australia. Still going strong. I sold the business in about 2013. But that I ran those workshops in Sydney for 6 years. So for 10 months of the year, every single month, I presented a 2-hour session to about 30 men who didn't want to be there. And about 20% of those men were signed in by their partner and didn't even know what they were coming to. And so it had to be funny and fast and jam-packed with info and story-driven. And that gave me an opportunity to get that content so good that I then licensed the program nationally, and I had presenters doing that content. So that gave me really good reps. And that's long. 2 hours to hold an audience is a long time. We go for an hour, have a pub dinner, go for another hour.
Tell me, Lucy, just on that. So you were helping dads navigate this, the birth part or early childhood or
The birth. It was about their role in childbirth. I used to say to them in the opener of this session, I'd say, if you listen tonight, and you do everything I tell you to, your partner will have an easier, faster birth. If you cock this up, you will be responsible for her having a slower, harder birth. And I'd have their full attention. They'd look at me, bunnies in the headlights, like, "Holy cow." And it was real practical advice. Like, this is how you mask the pain. This is why you don't talk to the midwife. This is what's going on in her brain, that you need to use heat. All the things they actually needed to do. And then I wrote the book that came out of that, so they could have more about breastfeeding and life with your baby and that kind of stuff.
Super.
So that's where I got my reps in. Then I became a CEO, and when you have that title, people invite you to speak. So I was able to practice, and we had an incredible story to tell. And I had a really clear call to action, which was we wanted people to donate to support our work. And I could practice that over the years. And then the same when I was working in Cambodia, that was health centers and schools. in a country where any education was fatal 40 years ago. So there were some huge barriers to education. So that's how I got my reps in. Then now that I'm a paid speaker, it's those road shows. Yeah. I use those as an opportunity. I say to the client, I want to do something brand new just for you and your people, and we work something out. And that's how I get that gorgeous, I'll get a whole new speech locked in my brain that way.
What's interesting about that, though, obviously the content is changing all the time. So you're saying the reps, though, is it the kind of the comfort you feel or the normality, or you use the word familiarity, right?
Yeah, it's all of that. The comfort of hearing someone say, and our next speaker, and hearing your flipping name, that used to make me go, and now I go, I'm up. It's the comfort in all those things, in getting onto the stage quickly, in managing whatever AV system they have for you. They could thrust a talking stick in your hand. They could have already mic'd you up. You might have a headset and not realize that big hoop earrings are going to bang against that headset. Like, you figure all these things out on the road. And then, only then you start speaking to these people. So there's lots of things to get used to. Your timing as well is a really important aspect of being a good speaker, is being mindful of the time. If they ask you to speak for 45 minutes, you don't speak for 55. You don't walk off at 25. You speak for the amount of time you are booked to speak, and it's really disrespectful to screw that up. And I see it all the time. So timing is important, and knowing how to keep time without looking at your watch on stage. So you learn all these things, become comfortable with these things. Then it's the content. The content comes after all these details in delivery.
Yeah.
And then you get comfortable with telling things in different ways. So you may have this really amazing piece of research that you want to reference. I always say, you know, you make a point, you reference the science, and then you tell a story to kick that home. That's a really nice structure for about 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
If you have 30 minutes to speak in, do 10 of those. It'll be a fabulous speech. So make a point, reference the science, the neurology, the behavioral science, the study, whatever, and you've got to tell that in a way that's really, because some studies are so complex, you've just got to break it down to the absolute basics of the findings. Sometimes you don't even bother with the study. You just go, they discovered that, and then tell a story. And the story is where the magic happens, where your voice moves differently, where that's where you can make people really laugh. And so the comfort is in how those pieces relate to each other, practicing making them better. I realize I've always done this with writing. Every single word should audition to get in, no wasted words, especially in things like fundraising and advertising. You know, you've got a headline, you've really got a maximum of 3 or 4 words in a headline. Can be no extra words in a headline or in a call to action. You've got to work out ways of saying things in a really compact and impactful way. Speaking should be the same. And I realized when I was given, say, a 25-minute block, I had to really compact some stories down so I could still get the juice in. The stories were no less awesome. So that meant I could, in a 60-minute block, I could make this speech so much juicier. Instead of telling longer stories with more detail, I could actually keep it compact, and there's more room for more juice for happy audiences. So the practice is in those storytellings, getting them more compact, really realizing which bits the audience goes, at what they need to get them to an R. Because sometimes you need to explain a few story pieces to get the drop in the story, to get the There's probably two big ohs that I deliver to audiences where they just go, how crap is life? And then it's
Can you tell us? Like, can you share an example of this kind of the structure you're talking about?
One is about when I was fired from a job, and it was so heartbreaking and it was so brutally done. And I explain that. And usually there's one person in my audience that laughs. I usually point at them and say, are you the kind of person that laughs at funerals? Because this is that story. And then that gives the audience a little bit of relief, because it's awful. Like, I was incredibly good at my job and I was fired unceremoniously.
Wow.
And then I need to explain the story arc for how I discovered why I was fired. And that's the next big drop. It was utterly corrupt. And no one expects that a white lady in a country like Australia will be a victim of absolute, um, of of corruption. And it even gives me goosebumps when I tell the story. So two big drops. Then it's my job, because you can't leave an audience anywhere but on an absolute fist pumping high. Then it's my job to bring them out of that and see what I learned from it and what you can learn from what I went through, and then some awesome steps for how a big vacuum in your life like that gives you incredible space for opportunity. And this is what happened next. So it gives the audience hope and motivation and inspiration. I used to hate that word, but inspiration, but I hear it all the time. The client wants someone inspiring. We're looking for an inspirational speaker. Okay. Yeah. Yes, I can do that.
It's interesting, isn't it? My wife is a professional speaker. I certainly don't think in the same kind of category as yourself, Lucy, far more in the kind of the engineering space. And so a lot of her talks are more kind of technical, or kind of to technical audiences, and often usually
around. I come on after someone like her because she's been so freaking clever. And the audience is so, their brains are like, oh my goodness, that woman was so good. And they've recorded it because she's so intense and there's so much information they need to take home, and their brains are literally full. So I come on after someone like your wife. Because
you're the lighthearted version, but to lift them. And I think it's a really interesting skill, that, right? Because trying to lift people is really hard. Trying to lift a room of 1,000 people conceptually.
Well, 1,000 is quite easy. A huge group of people are quite infectious.
Interesting.
And yeah. So as long as I can pitch it to them just right and they get my humor in the early stages of the speech, a big room full of 1,000 is really easy to please. They make each other laugh. And the warmth in that sound triggers endorphins and everyone feels good. Whether they liked my speech or not, they come out feeling good. You mentioned my hair. I often speak to a room full of people who I can tell are looking at me, and they've got their arms crossed. They've usually got big pot bellies, and they cross their arm. They're resting it on their farmer's belly.
Yeah.
And they look at me like, what's this chick gonna? What has she got to say? Ugh. And then it's my job very quickly to show them that I'm relatable. Who'd have thought that, you know, like a cotton farmer from central Queensland could relate to this woman on stage. Mm. And that my humour they can relate to as well. So my stories, my background and my humour, they're like, this chick's the bomb. And then I watch them slowly, literally open like a flower.
Wow.
I love it. And I watch them gradually uncross their arms until they're literally leaning forward looking at me. And they've all moved so that I can see every single face.
Wow.
And then I know I've cracked them and they're loving what I've got to give. And it almost wouldn't matter where I left them. I took them where they needed to go. And those are heavy male audiences.
So, and the moving faces, you mean by like they're trying to like make sure they can see you outside of the person who's sat in front of them, yeah?
Yeah, so they all move. So they look like a perfectly arranged bunch of flowers. You know when flowers are arranged absolute perfection? That's what an audience looks like, because they've all moved. No one's phone fiddling. No one's got their laptop out. And I don't tell them to do that. I just think it's my job. I compete with all those entertainment devices. I'm competing with their emails and, you know, text messages from their missus. And I've got to be that engaging. That's the job I do. And I don't use a slideshow as well. I don't have any images or words behind me, because brains can only do one thing at a time well. And if you put a bunch of words up behind you, they're suddenly not listening to a word you're saying, because now they're reading. Different part of the brain, and they just can't do two things well. Take texting and driving, for example. You just can't. Your brain can only flick quickly and do it badly. So that's why I don't have slideshows. Just me and my glorious head.
Tell me, when it comes to, if you were to give advice to someone who's having to, maybe having to do talks like this, perhaps not on a stage, but maybe to their team, and they're finding themselves like begrudgingly almost there, and that they thought promotion was a good idea, and now they're like, oh crikey, I really don't like this part of my job, as it were. What? How would you counsel them?
In a few ways. So firstly, no audience, no matter how small or how enormous, wants you to crash and burn, because it's agonizing for the audience. They're all selfish creatures. We just don't want them to crash because we'll be uncomfortable. And so they're already behind you. So you get up in front of a team of 15 or 30 people, they're already smiling at you. They want you to succeed because it'd be agonizing if you didn't. So there's that for a start. Then I would say know what you need to say, and practice it in a conversational way. So my speaking style is very conversational because it's easier to remember things in a spoken way, and it's really forgiving. I can go, oh, let me just back up. I want to tell you a story about this. I've completely cocked up the flow of my speech. But the audience is so forgiving because I've been very conversational in my style, I can correct a cock up and nobody minds. You get up there and you give a very lecture style speech, and you've got constructed or a recital. I see a lot of speakers struggle when they try to recite.
Yeah.
The problem with that is if you go off course, it's like when you learn a piece on the piano and you only know how to play it from the start. You don't read the music and you can't just jump into that bit. I actually saw a speaker bomb really badly, and she did it over and over, and I could tell it was because she tried to recite this story phrase by phrase. Bad. Just remember the overarching detail, the overarching kind of story arc, what you need to get said, and get it done in a conversational way if you're presenting, say, just to a team. When it comes to humor, I'm often asked about this because I'm a funny speaker. If you're naturally funny in person, you'll find speaking, you'll find humorous speaking really easy, because you'll spot the little funny quips you would make in conversation anyway. If you're not a naturally funny person, that'll just take a bit more technical work. And then there's ways to bring in humor if you're not accustomed to it, like wild contrast is a really easy way to bring in humor. And what I call surprise and delight, you take people in this direction, but you land them in that one. And it's the delight of that sort of, hang on a sec, that makes an audience laugh. So that's how you can test if a joke is going to be funny and is going to land. But with a team, it's about just being natural, being you, eye contact with, when it's a small audience, you can give every single person eye contact in that room. I actually find speaking to 20 harder than 20,000.
Why is that?
See every single person.
Yeah.
It's harder for things to become infectious in that room. If they can see you, they can also see each other. And then there's dynamics in that room you don't even know about. So there might be relationships or baggage in that room that means that this person doesn't want to laugh out loud. That person will get annoyed if this person's loving every minute of it and nodding at the bits that might apply to them. in a big crowd, everyone's got a sense of anonymity, and they can just enjoy it in their own right. So, yeah, those 14 prezos can be tough.
When it comes to speaking internationally, how do you find your humour, Aussie humour, translates? And also the message, can you do the same thing in front of an American audience and they love it as much?
Yes, to a point. So the message is the same because we're all humans. The message is the same. The learnings are the same. The neuroscience is the same. The vernacular is different. So I have to just adapt some of the words I use to an American audience. I just sent some video. I've got a manager in the States, and I just sent her a video, and she said, I can't show this to my clients here. They would freak out because I used the term Jillaroo. So I talked about how when I first left school, I worked as a Jillaroo, and they don't use that term in the States. And they would go, what the hell is that? Is it a stripper? I don't know. So
what the hell is that, Lucy? Just for I'm
a Jillaroo is like a farmhand.
Right.
You cut cattle, you drive a tractor. And
Cool.
it's a real culture of that in Australia. A Jillaroo is a girl and a Jackaroo is a boy. And there's a lot of kids take a year off after school and go and work as Jillaroos. And you can do Jillaroo school and herding cattle, and it's rough and ready and you're in the outback, and I learned some amazing life lessons. And so I sometimes talk about that part of wasn't really my career. I did it for a fun move right after school. But I always lean on that when I'm speaking to a regional audience. I get a round of applause when I say I have built fences, because it's really hard. Dig fences.
Yeah, I've built fences too on a farm.
Yeah, I get a round of applause from a regional audience when I mention I worked at the Jillaroo. They love me. But you can't use terms like that in the States.
Yeah.
So I just have to tweak some of my very Aussie language and shortenings and make sure I'm using language that they totally get. And I also swear a lot less. So I only swear in a speech if the swearing is part of the story or it's part of you need it to understand. So I have a story where I talk about how when a girl is born, she's born with a jar of fucks to give. Now, that wouldn't work if I couldn't say fucks to give. And then when she turns 40, and this is how it ends, so when she turns 40, the jar disappears. She has no more fucks to give. And that's me just explaining that as women age, and men tell me it's the same for them, as women age, they start caring a whole lot less about what other people think. So don't bother trying to convince a woman over 40 of anything much. She is pretty single-minded and focused. So that's what that story's about. And it wouldn't work without an F-bomb in there. In the Australian context, depending on the client, I remember once there's a funny story and the punchline was around having frequent fucker points. And it wouldn't be funny without that phrase. And so the client was a major bank. And after the roadshow, and the client came to me and went, oh, the big boss has heard that you use the word frequent fucker and he's kind of freaking out about that. What should we do? And I said, I'll fix it. You'll see. Next speech, next city. I told the story because it was part of a really juicy piece of content. And I told that story and I said, that F-bomb is not sponsored by ANZ Bank. That is a gift from me to you. And it got another laugh and it did exactly what we needed to do, which was distance the word from the client, and everyone was really happy.
That's and the cool. Client
was really chuffed.
Yeah.
I've heard speakers just use swearing as like adjectives, and that's not how I present at all.
Just on my loose, is it because the Americans don't relate to swearing like we do? Is it we're different in terms of that, in terms of an Aussie audience?
Yeah, I think so. And also there's a much higher percentage of Americans are really religious.
Got
so
you.
Australia, we're a declining religious population, and in the States, if anything, it's an increasing one. So there's just that respect for more than half, probably depending on where you go, more than 60% of that audience will be church-going people.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So it's that too.
Just seems crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So in Australia, for example, I spoke for a room full of mortgage brokers in Port Douglas late last year, and those are really wealthy people, really down to earth.
Yeah.
And the second I dropped an F-bomb right at the start of that speech, I remember, it was like they all went, oh, yeah, we're going to like her. It's almost like an Aussie familiarity thing. It's not mass to us. It's just part of how we speak. I'm just mindful that I only use it to enrich what I'm saying, that it doesn't get to the point where it's like, oh, she swears too much. I've never been. Yeah.
When it doesn't go well, how do you how do you get it back on course? Because I'm just curious. You've painted a really beautiful picture that you're on there, you can command these audiences, you've got the guy who's, you know, all tense up and he relaxes and he moves his head and all that. I'm sure there must be times where it doesn't quite go to plan, or maybe sometimes, and this kind of speaks to your the council culture we've seen and what happened in terms of that response. How do you navigate those periods when actually they almost turn against you?
Okay, so as a speaker, I've certainly never had an audience turn against me.
Right.
The closest I have come, two occasions. One was in Brisbane. The audience was They I can't remember the industry. I think it was banking, finance. I've done a lot of speaking in the finance world, and they were mainly men over 65. So I needed to relate to them like my granddad kind of thing, and they were just so flat. And I did my best, and I threw everything at them that I could, and I laughed at my own jokes. And that's what you do when they don't laugh; you just laugh at your own jokes. And it was flat as a pancake. And then afterwards, there was a queue of these older finance dudes queuing to tell me that was the best speech they'd ever heard in their lives. I'm like, well, your face didn't tell me. Next time, make sure the speaker knows you're enjoying yourself. And then there was another time I spoke in Queenstown, and again, finance industry. And for some reason, that crowd, it was all men, but with their wives. So their wives didn't work in the industry. They were like on a handbag tour, I call that, where the wife gets to come along and they have a partner's sort of program. And the wives absolutely loved everything I had to give. And so I did, so the whole audience did. It went across really well. I go to Queenstown a lot. It's such a big conference town. Went across really well, and then I was flying home, or I had just arrived home, and I got an email from the booking client, like the boss guy, and he said, "Ma, we have mixed reviews. It didn't really land with some of our audience." And I replied and said, "You could have fooled me, because the feedback from the audience almost knocked me off the back of that stage. But okay, I'll take that on." And then it made me feel rubbish. Because I'm like, what do you mean mixed reviews? Who didn't like my speech? Oh, it makes you feel terrible. And one of the best speakers in Australia is a guy named Bernard Salt. And he used to be a partner for KPMG. He's a demographer. Do you know who Bernard is?
From AFO as well, right? He
He
was
runs
with
the
them for a
Australian.
period.
Yeah, he
Oh,
runs
he's
the
sorry.
Australian. Still does, yeah. And he and I have done a roadshow together. You bond with these other speakers when you do roadshows. And I messaged him and said, it's the first time this has ever happened to me where the client says, meh, it was a bit eh. And he said, they're idiots, Lucy. Do not listen to a word they say. He said, 10 years ago, I had got mixed reviews and the client was like, meh, about a speech I gave in Mackay. He said, I've hated Mackay ever since. That poor town, I've hated Mackay for a decade. He said, just blow them off. Don't worry about it. He said it was probably one person didn't like it that his missus laughed really hard at that particular joke or something. Don't worry about it. And it was the best advice. And I was just onward. And I remember I was flying back. I had to go from Queenstown straight to Melbourne to give another speech. Had I not had that awesome little text chat with Bernard, I think I would have approached that next speech in a less confident way. And that speech went on to create so much business for me, that ne the Melbourne one. There's always a few speech bookings in your audience, but if I hadn't come at them with complete enthusiasm, that may not have happened. So I guess the short answer to your question is, I've never lost an audience. Certainly never been booed or dragged off. And I have heard stories. Yeah, I booked for a gig last year and they said, look, our speaker last year, we had to send the MC on stage and kind of shoo him off. So tough audience. It was in Outback Australia. Tough audience. They're drinking hard. It's an awards night. And yeah, it was only a 25-minute slot and I flipping nailed it. But you hear these stories because they hurt the client and it goes into their feelings. Yeah.
Don't be like ex speaker. Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, after every single speech, I note down what I could do better. I record every speech I give, every single speech I record, a voice recording on my phone for a bunch of reasons. It might be the best speech I give of my entire life, would like a copy. They might invite me back next year, and I think, flip, better check what I said last year so I can do all new content for them. Or I invite you back for a new cohort, and they go, just do that again. So then I know what I did. So that, and I was initially doing it for feedback with a voice coach. Now I just do it as record keeping. And I might meet someone at the airport who said, oh, I missed your speech. And I can go, here we go. I'll send it to your phone right now. Oh, I wish my daughter could have heard you speak. Oh, here we go. I'll just send it to you.
That's
Listen to
cool.
your car. And so I note down what I know I could do better from every single speech I give. The audience might not know it. They might not know that I missed this little piece that ties this and this together. Or a couple of weeks ago, I finished a speech 6 minutes early. That's really unlike me. I usually finish right on, or I'm on time. And I say to whoever booked me, do we have time for one more story? And they always say yes and give me another 5 minutes. And I speak a bit more. But afterwards, I was like, how did I come in 6 minutes early? What did I miss? What was missing? And then and I had to listen back and figure out there was one juicy story where my brain just moved beyond it. I'd been dropping it from speeches for other reasons. And so that self-reflection is really important. The audience won't know what they missed out on, but I need to keep getting better.
Yeah. Awesome. You've written a number of books now. I'm intrigued. What is it about the manuscript that your kind of more recent books? Obviously, you've got two books and maybe more, Lucy, forgive me. I'm just going off what the notes show me here.
Yeah, sure. It's four books. So I wrote Cheers to Childbirth, which is the dad's guide to childbirth support. That was first published in 2010. That keeps selling because people keep breeding. And it's quite well known. It's recommended by obstetricians and midwives. Then there's another book called From Lads to Dads, and that's a collection of birth stories. And it's an ebook. So every time I meet someone interesting and I do another birth story, that book just gets fatter. You can't get enough of men can't get enough from the men's perspective. It's really important that they hear it from the man's perspective. Because women will tell the same birth, like they'll be at the same birth, totally different story. So men need to hear it from other men. Then I wrote my memoir, Get the Girls Out. That was commissioned in 2015. I didn't publish it till 2019 because it was agonizing to write. That sells really well at events. Once people hear me speak, they're like, oh, I want to hear this chick's backstory. So that book keeps selling. And then I published a novel last year. And that's the cancellation you've referred to a few times. So I published a novel, my first novel. That was a lot of fun to write. It's about a woman who's writing a novel, and as people in her personal life treat her badly, she writes them into the plot and kills them off. It's really fun to write. There's only one decapitation, but it's accidental.
Okay. And is this
one actually said on the cover? It said, "If you loved Killing Eve, you'll really enjoy this book because it has got some pretty surprising moments of violence." And I committed a sin that I didn't know was a sin at the time. And so I retell this story and I wrote a blog in detail about this so other authors will learn. But authors are not allowed to comment on book reviews. I didn't know this. Nobody told me this. My publicist didn't tell me. No one told me that authors are meant to just produce a 98,000-word newborn baby all slippery into the world. And then someone who can't even construct a paragraph can tell you you're a shit writer. That's the way of the world. I didn't know this. There were 100 copies of my book were sent out to reviewers, but far too many of them were amateur wannabe Instagram reviewers, not in my readership. So that it was my publicist not doing the right thing. And a copy of my book was put in the hands of someone 20 years younger than my readership. And she came to the launch of the book. We met. We'd had a bit of online chit-chat. And she wrote a stinging review. And so because we'd had a conversation beforehand, I think if I hadn't met her, I wouldn't have bothered. But we had met. And I said, there's some contradictions in your review. And that just unleashed the most incredible 3 months of my life.
Wow.
So she and her little network of trolls spent 3 months trying to do real commercial damage to me and my family. 65,000 just on Instagram, 65,000 accounts smashed through my Instagram account telling me to eat shit and die.
Wow.
Threats, the works. They worked out where I live. They booked out all the tickets to my launch events online so that real people couldn't book to come. My whole Queensland leg of the tour was cancelled because the venues couldn't guarantee my safety. It was really, really awful. And the only reason why it went away was they found a new victim.
Wow.
And it really bothers me. Like, the next person may not have the support network I have, or be in the mental good, like in a robust mental place to cope. If this had happened to me 6 months later, where I had to have emergency surgery and there was all this other crazy stuff going on, it could have tipped me well and truly over the edge. It was horror. The safety commissioner got involved. The police were involved. It was full on.
Wow.
It seemed the punishment was so outweighed what I did wrong. It bothered me so much that it only stopped when they found it. It's almost like they're lying in wait for the next author who doesn't know this little rule to destroy them. And then they rush off onto review sites, and it's called review bombing, where they've never read a book. Sometimes it's not even a book that's even out yet. So people have given one star, like thousands of one star reviews to a book that hasn't even been published yet, because someone has decided, let's cancel that author.
Wow.
And there have been cases where authors have lost their publisher because of this kind of online bullying. It frustrated them no end that I own the publishing company and I fired my publicist. And I learned through that process a bunch of things. One of them was, don't comment on book reviews.
Yeah.
If you wind back into hindsight, don't give books to people who aren't in your readership, who've barely finished a degree and probably aren't the best reviewers anyway. That it just shouldn't be going outside of your readership. Why bother?
Yeah.
But I also learned, the bigger the star, the bigger the silence. And I pass it on all the time. So when I see friends being hammered by someone and then they'll turn that into a post and some discussion on this, I just private message them and just say, the bigger the star, the bigger the silence. When you leave an echo chamber for their shitty comments, they look like a dick. And it goes away quicker when there's less of, and it's really hard not to defend, or like I was just using humor at first because some of it was really funny. So someone said, gave me a review. She'd never read the book, but said, I wouldn't even use this book for toilet paper. And so I screenshot that and said, I do not recommend this book for your butthole. See? Hilarious. It gave me a tickle. It absolutely lit a fire under their ass of total hatred. Wow. And then they jumped on TikTok and they were doxing on TikTok, which I didn't even know what doxing was, asking other people to abuse me, posting everything they knew about me so they could abuse me across every single platform.
Oh, my God.
The only platform where I wasn't hammered was LinkedIn.
Yeah.
I looked at the stats and all these trolls, sorry, I live on a busy road sometimes, all these trolls were between the ages of 17 and 22. And they were almost all women.
Young. Wow.
There was a sprinkling of men, but they were only, they were influencers. They had like a blue tick and they had a big following and they'd noticed all this noise and they'd just come for a look and gone, yikes, and then got out of there. So that led me on another discovery, which I spoke on a lot during the International Women's Day season, which is a concept called lateral violence. And I'd never heard of this. And it's a social phenomenon that when a group of oppressed people are oppressed for long enough, they will turn on themselves. And most of the research around lateral violence is Aboriginal communities and nurses, because nurses are part of a system where they're really oppressed, that they have no powers, that doctors come in and just get it all done above them. And so so nurses turn on each other and women do the same thing.
Wow.
I learned that and thought, well, those 65,000 young women from all over the world who told me to eat shit and die are women who feel really oppressed. And it helped me see that it's actually not about me. I was just the latest kind of target for their oppression, oppressed feelings. And so that helped me rationalize. I just need to ignore them and keep ignoring them.
I want to go back a step, Luce, if you don't mind. Bigger the star, bigger the silence, you said. Just tell me, unpack that a little bit. In terms, are you saying that the bigger the star, the bigger, like they should leave the gap? Is that what you're saying? A bit like kind of Kate Milton.
Don't even bother responding.
Right.
So Sally Hepworth is one of Australia's biggest are higher selling authors. And she private messaged me. She used to do reels of her reading her one-star reviews and laughing at them. And because, you know, when people read mean
tweets, really funny when you do that, yeah.
Really funny. The effort people go to, and they usually, you know, here they are full of typos, can't construct a sentence telling you you can't write. And she said, I don't do that anymore. And she doesn't respond in any way to anything negative at all. Another quite high profile person said to me, Mia Friedman, she's been cancelled at various times. She said, it'll only go away when you apologise, apologise again, apologise one more time, and then never respond to anything about it ever again. So that's what I took from it, the biggest star, the bigger the silence. And I follow a few really big stars online, and awful comments just dangle. They just sit there looking like a dick.
Mm.
They don't give it any oxygen at all.
Mm.
I said that years and years ago when social media first started to tick along, and I was maximising Facebook for our fundraising for the Ethiopian charity, and I remember a designer who worked for me said, do not feed the trolls, Lucy. Do not feed the trolls. He was a really quiet guy, and it was one of the longest sentence he ever said out loud. Do not feed the trolls.
Wow.
That's good advice.
Good advice. Lucy, I think that might be a great place to leave this conversation. I've taken a heap of notes on my side just in terms of tips, and I'm sure people have found it super insightful, not just for what you get wrong around motivation, but actually how to do a great speech and what it actually takes to perform at the highest level in that regard. How can people reach out to you, Lucy? What's the best way to find you if that's something they want to do after listening to this?
Fine. If you just Google Lucy Bloom, can't miss me. Otherwise, thelucybloom.com is my website. And my social media handle is @thelucybloom for all my platforms. So I'm easy to find.
Awesome. Lucy, thank you so much for taking the time out to chat to us.
My pleasure.